Very cool. I got Justin Leggett on the Capital Razor Show, now brought to you by PitchDecks.com and Richard Wilson. Very cool to meet you, my friend. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Happy to be on the show with you.
Rock and roll. All right, man. So you're partnering up with somebody I've previously had on the show, Devin Elder. How are things going in your business right now?
Oh, man, things are great. Super, super busy first part of 2022. We had a number of, a big multifamily offering that we closed on, and then also some ranch investments that are a newer part of our business that we've kind of rolled out over the last year that has been real interesting and a nice complement to the long-term nature of the multifamily syndications.
Fascinating. Hey, I've interviewed some of Devin's previous partners and friends and students. I'm talking about Ruben Dominguez.
Quite a few.
Yeah, Abel Pacheco.
Definitely.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about your integration into DJE. Well, actually, even before we go there, how about you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into multifamily syndication?
I got to DJE. Devin and I hooked up in early 2020, February of 2020. But before that, I spent the majority of my career in the investment management business, in marketing and relationship and business development roles for about 15 years. Started off as a financial advisor, was licensed with my Series 7, 66, 24, into the gills with all that stuff, and worked long enough within that structure or that sort of organization to really kind of become very disenfranchised by the public equities markets and just how things happen and what people end up with versus the kind of aspirational imagery that I was coming up with on a daily basis with my designers for marketing materials and things of that nature to generate business. And it was at that point that I took a little bit of a break from business, just did consulting with financial services firms, creative firms. Like I said, in 2018 is really kind of whenever I jumped back into kind of the investment game. And it was with a private equity firm up in Austin. And I worked with them to help them gain SEC approval, market, and then break escrow on a private market multifamily REIT that focused on properties throughout the Sunbelt region. And it was a really interesting product, but I really kind of wanted to focus, like just have more focus. I was like running investor relations with them, marketing as well, and had designers reporting to me. And I started off as a marketing consultant and didn't really kind of see myself kind of being like having direct reports in this sort of situation. And I wanted to have more focus and more focus on the type of activities that were high level activities that I thought were the kind of things that I could really only do myself. And so that was about the time that me and Devin crossed paths. I was trying to get down to San Antonio to be closer to family. And it just really, really worked out. I think that there's a lot of alignment there from a stylistic standpoint. Not to say that we have the same styles. We're very different, I guess, from a stylistic standpoint on a personal and professional level. But it works, I think, as far as our roles and what we do here and how we handle the investors and what we do for them. But yes, since I came on board with them, it has been a growth story. I started in February of 2020. Literally, I think like a month later, shelter in place orders happened. And it was just a very, very strange time to kind of be in a role where you're meeting people for the first time through a Zoom. It really kind of causes us to look at a lot of different things or some other things a different way. And then shortly after I came on board, another big kind of inflection point in our business was that Eli Acevedo, who's the chief operations officer for DJE Properties, which is our in-house property management company. We integrated that side of the business all under the same roof. I don't think we knew it at the time, or at least I didn't, but that was just a huge, huge inflection point, like I said, that I think really kind of gave us the impetus and the confidence to go after a lot of the deals that we've done over the last 2 years and the growth that we've experienced.
Cool. I'll definitely be interested to talk about what you know about the timeline of DJE. But I'm very curious about a couple of things that I'm pretty uneducated about, specifically the licensing, that the different types of licenses that financial advisors need to get. And then also curious about this word that's very loosely used. You said private equity firm. From your perspective, what is a private equity firm?
From my perspective, it is basically an investment firm that is offering private market securities to private investors. I think that there is a lot of misconstruing what a private equity firm is. I think is a lot of times it gets mixed up with like the sexier side of venture capital investing and angel investing and all those sort of things. But as far as I'm concerned, private equity firms are focused largely on just bringing private market investment instruments to private, highly affluent investors.
Would you disagree with the thought that, because here's what I've heard about private equity shops or firms, is that they're essentially capital sources for other syndicators. Can I refer to a fund that strokes big checks into my deals as a private equity firm?
I believe you can. Yeah, I mean, you can operate in that capacity. And I think that there's a large population of firms that are just pooling their relationships with investor capital. And that's usually like accredited investors and very, very high dollar check limits. And but those firms are also going to want to have a disproportionate say in the management and the and calling the shots on that sort of thing. We may be a private equity firm, and that might not be the way that we operate, but we've never had a need to go to those sort of private equity firms for funding purposes and things of that nature, because we don't want to control as such a premium value of ours that giving up that amount on of the potential success of the investment not only goes against what we believe, but I think it's just from a brand standpoint, it just wouldn't jive with what we've been telling our investors we stand for a number of years.
Sure. Yeah. So what Justin's talking about is like when you're working with these single checks writers, a lot of times they're either institutions or family offices that want a lot of control, that want to micromanage you, that want to rewrite your docs. They want to have the ability to kick you out if you misperform and the ability to yell at you if you don't provide reports on times and stuff like that. So it can be a challenge to work with these companies, but we've talked about this in the past on previous episodes. What I'm really curious about is the licensing. You mentioned, I think, a 66 and a 24 and a 70 something. What are all the licenses that you have?
I don't have them anymore. You have to keep them up, and you have about a 2-year time period after you separate from a registered broker dealer, because a broker dealer has to like say, hey, I'm going to hold your licenses. So you got 2 years after that. And since I'm not on that side of the fence anymore and really don't have any desire to be, I had the 7, which is your general securities principle that allows you to do it's similar to the 6, but like on steroids. It allows you to do stock, options, derivatives, commodities, all the really, really kind of dangerous stuff for middle America kind of thing. And then the 24 was a sales principal license that was for managing internal sales desks and wholesalers and things of that nature whenever I was in the mutual fund game. And then the 66 is your fee-based kind of like your blue sky law stuff that allows you to hold yourself out as an investment advisor. I don't really play in that side of the business anymore, and it's not really my chosen path. It does come in handy. You know, there's a lot of credibility that comes with understanding being a marketing and a relationship builder and an investor relations person that actually has dealt with the products, not only that we're dealing with, but also on a larger scale in the investment industry, does seem to help our investors feel a lot more confident as far as, especially whenever they lay out everything else that's kind of happening with their portfolio. And while we really can't speak or advise to the overall kind of quarterback mentality of that sort of arrangement, we can at least be cognizant and make sure that the strategies that they're interested in or that we're recommending to them aren't going to fly in the face or cause any sort of disastrous consequences for their current investment situation.
So looking back at your timeline, everything that you've done has gotten you to where you are today. That's always a great thing. However, right. if you could recommend to a previous version of yourself or a younger self, would you have taken the path to do what you did? Or for somebody out there, would you say, hey, you don't need any licenses to become a capital raiser within multifamily syndication or a marketer or GP within a structure?
You definitely do not need securities licenses, especially to play in the multifamily and syndication world. I don't want to get up on a soapbox as far as regulatory bodies and securities licenses, but there is a large amount of like barriers to entry and speed bump kind of thing to make sure that you have to pass a test that has a certain level of difficulty to be able to transact in certain types of securities. Now, I think that the position sometimes maybe from a regulatory standpoint needs to be looked at a little bit closer, because I feel like our regulatory bodies and like people that say this is what an accredited investor is and this is what a non-accredited investor is, I don't feel like it's the most like topically aware sort of interpretation of what's actually happening with investors and what good or an accredited or non-accredited sophisticated investor looks like. But that being said, I think that those sort of licenses can help people. It can help you have a more comprehensive view of everything that's out there, and it allows people to operate, I think, with a little bit more confidence as far as how they fit into the overall puzzle with a client, But at the same time, it is definitely not something, especially from like a curriculum standpoint, that is going to show up practically in your investor relations mentality or your syndication structure.
Yeah, the reason I ask you is because I get a lot of questions. Hey, Ruben, do you think I should go get a securities license? Do I need that to start my own fund? Do I need that to syndicate? I hear that there's all these regulatory laws that I have to follow, and I just want to make sure that I'm doing everything correctly. Do I need this license? And my lawyer said that I need this license. Well, a lawyer gets paid to have you put together docs with them, and they may not give you business advice. They'll be happy to write your syndication docs, but they may not be the best business advisors. So I often refer them to Joel Block, who's my friend that has done a lot of syndication and hedge fund symposiums. And I've interviewed Joel a few times and even asked him about this. And he says, well, typically for a syndication, you don't need to have a license. However, there are certain situations where it makes sense to have a license, particularly if you're dealing with a lot of people that you don't know. There's a lot of insurances that these brokers have. And if you're concerned that you could potentially get sued, well, these guys have a better understanding of when and where it makes sense to work with people that they don't have a personal relationship with and can protect themselves a little bit better than the average syndicator. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Do you have a comment on this?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that there are absolutely benefits to it. I think I kind of like touched on that there are some benefits just for me. And for me, it's more of like what I was alluding to as far as like understanding where we fit into the client's overall financial picture. Because I mean, like, I'm not trying to be a bull in a china shop with anybody that is interested in learning more about what we do or the types of products that we create. And what I just want to do is present them with the information and the options and how that could theoretically work with the types of assets that they're already kind of invested in. But I'm definitely not giving investment advice, tax advice, that kind of thing. It is just really kind of an overall sort of theoretical idea of like, this is what we're offering you and these are the benefits of it. And theoretically, this is how it should work with your overall plan. But you really have to talk to the person, be it a financial advisor, CFP, CPA, or attorney, whoever it is, that is running quarterback on your overall investment and financial situation. We always make sure that as it relates to tax advice, legal advice, and specifically implementing financial advice, you definitely want to have one person that is really kind of running Monday morning quarterback on it so that they can keep an eye on all the disparate parts, the ports, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, my input is that the best way to raise capital is either through a fund structure or through a regulatory like Reg D 506 B or C exemption that allows you to be treated like a entity and yet raise capital and participate in the raising of equity without having to be licensed. So my input is you don't need that license in most cases. However, I am not legal counsel, so.
Yeah, sure. I'm not aware of any situations or at least ones practically that we've dealt with where a license was required.
One little thing that is though that like if you do get a license, you typically have to hang your license with the broker and then you're stuck with whatever that broker tells you that they want you to do.
Exactly.
So that's, I ran across a syndicator that it was not allowed to raise capital for the deals that he wanted to because he was forced to do what his broker wanted him to do. So
it doesn't really reek of objectivity. Because I mean, like if you're just hanging your license with a broker dealer, they are going to have some sort of say as far as like what you have to produce and then also the products that are available and whether or not you deal in any of those products, there's an optic to that situation that you have a relationship with an organization that tells you these are the approved products that you could sell. If I'm a client and the investment management business is moving more and more towards fee-based financial planning or sort of like fee-based for execution or just for the advice. And I see that somebody's associated with a broker dealer. I'm like, well, that doesn't reek of complete objectivity and like a standalone sort of investment firm to me.
True that. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about marketing. So what kind of marketing did you do for your private equity firm, the previous one, and how has it helped you with the marketing that you do with DJE?
A big part of it, I think something that really kind of stemmed out of the licensing, strangely enough, a benefit, was I've always really been effective in marketing roles. And the large half of my 15, 17 years in the investment management business was purely marketing roles, where I was basically right under the reporting to the chief marketing officer. And I had event planners, graphic designers, everybody kind of coming at me. the kind of marketing that they were doing up to that point was just largely ineffective because it was an intellectual and a creative exercise. And they hadn't had somebody in the business, because the CMO is out glad handing and working events and conferences and things of that nature, but they didn't have somebody who came from the business side into the marketing department. And at that point, I was really kind of not only in business development, but was also operationally working. I was very, very involved in the CRM system, which kind of goes into like a big part of what all investor relations people should be doing, is focusing on whatever technology you have available to make your life easier. But we'll talk more about that in a bit. But basically, my most effective part of my career from a marketing standpoint has been just focusing on solving problems and not focusing on making it pretty. Making it pretty needs to happen, and aesthetics are important, especially as it relates to user experience and design. But first and foremost, you have to solve the problem. And very quickly in my career, I was able to connect the creative exercises with the practical aspects of solving problems. And so our marketing seemed to get quite a bit more effective back then. And then that's really kind of what I applied to the REIT that I was working in. But unfortunately, it's just as we moved past getting approval with the SEC was something that I was working with them on. And then also starting to build out all the marketing processes and then moving towards breaking escrow with our first clients. It kind of, once we started going through it and actually developing business, it kind of just seemed like the idealism behind the product, this idea of having a extremely low cost or minimum investment amount and having access to a fund of private market multifamily assets, it was very idealistic and it looked so good. But like whenever we actually started developing business, it was just, we had the wrong audience. And it was very, very hard to get the thing off of the ground just because at a $1,000 minimum investment and using marketing strategies like AdWords strategies and things like that, that only kind of exponentially or exacerbate the wrong client type of situation. It just made it very hard to kind of get up to a point to where we had some run rate and we were kind of sustaining things along with deal flow issues. So I like the aspect raising funds for a fund or a REIT is quite a bit easier, but that's also because you're dealing with investors who are making lower investment amounts. And so there's not as much risk associated, which usually corresponds to the amount of due diligence that gets done. Once I came down here and I really started focusing on raising funds for standalone investments, 506B syndications primarily, it really kind of allowed me to connect my creative and business side of my brains that I'd kind of built on in the past, but really kind of connect it with a client base that had been built up and had a lot of just unearthed brand equity in it. And so over the years since I've been here, I've really kind of just been focusing on what are continuing the type of marketing activities that will continue to solve those sort of business problems for people and will really kind of make us the type of firm that focus on practical things from a marketing standpoint, while at the same time, just making sure that, because like, you know, whenever I got here, things like social media, for example, weren't paid as much attention to the point where like we were kind of starting from scratch. So that was something that I really had to get up off the ground. Like for Instagram, for example, was one channel that we hadn't really done, made a big break in. And while I don't think that there's a huge pull or a huge amount of results that we get out of Instagram, it is a validation tool for people now. It allows you to make a cultural play. And the fact that we deal in physical assets, Instagram is a perfect platform for that, like, you know, for showing the evolution and the transformation of our value add strategy. So doing those sort of things and kind of like trying to be mindful of like, how do we construct an overall like picture of what kind of marketing needs to happen here to yield results, but at the same time, really just making sure that they're yielding results. And if they're not, then pivoting to something else that we think can.
Cool. Talk to us a little bit about DJE. What has DJE been doing for the last 5-10 years? Where are they today?
DJE is manned by the principal of Devin Elder. Like I said, I joined in February of 2020. We were a pretty small firm back then, but he actually got his start in the same way that a lot of multifamily syndicators get started, kind of in the single family game, fixing and flipping and things like that. I think that he was doing that prior to 2012, whenever he was a full-time employee and had a sales and marketing career in technology. But in 2012, that's when he made the big jump and continued to really kind of do the fix and flip thing for a while until I think he was able, he got to a point where he just had to get like a moment of clarity, whatever you want to call it, but he pulled off of the training that he received from a sales and marketing standpoint in his corporate background and was able to just basically identify that he wasn't going to scale the business to the extent that he thought was absolutely possible, or that he thought was possible, by being so firmly entrenched on the active side of the investment dynamic. And that was really kind of what prompted him to start his evolution in education and multifamily investing, and started with education and networking, and then went on to joining maybe some smaller networking and investment groups, support groups kind of thing, and then moving on to doing your own smaller deals. Since 2012, we've acquired over 5,000 units, and we currently have around 2,200 doors under management. And that's a combination of our core portfolio and assets that we've raised funds for and taken over and are now operating. And then also a small number of third-party assets like Abel Pacheco or Ruben Dominguez. We act as the property manager or project manager on usually local San Antonio-based assets, where we have a really strong relationship with the operator and also a very close proximity to the asset.
Sweet. That's an amazing portfolio. Tell me a little bit about San Antonio multifamily. What's the market like there?
It's definitely not as attention-grabbing as DFW or Houston, and we absolutely love that about it. I feel like our style here at DJE is very reflective of kind of the under the radar and unassuming kind of style, humble style that our city has and is known for. It's Military Town USA. And so a huge, huge population of military, medical, there's a small tech scene popping up, and that tech scene is kind of happening like in the downtown area, which is where we're in the process of moving our headquarters. We actually closed recently on a historic building in downtown San Antonio that is going to be our new headquarters. It's really going to kind of be, I think, like a symbol that kind of acknowledges the strength of our connection to the city and how it's been a big part in allowing Devin and this organization to get to where we have been. But at the same time, kind of positioning ourselves to grow into the future, because the property management company, DJE Properties, went from 2 employees, I think, in May of 2020 to it's now over 75 people. And there's just a huge, like, there's a culture being built here. While the investment side of things and the side that I play on, it's not something that requires as much scaling, because like we're raising funds and Devin's handling a lot of the acquisition activity and deal flow and things of that nature. But there's just like really, really exciting things happening. And I think that it's a combination of us just coming under one roof and becoming one organization and kind of really seeing like the opportunities that are available, because I have to believe that whenever you're a fundraiser, whenever you're an investor relations person, there is inevitably a part of your own personal brand that gets inextricably linked to the partners that you choose to work with and raise funds for. And I don't think that I would be comfortable in a lot of settings unless we had the structure that we have here, being Devin's connection to not only the city, the fact that he was born and raised here, and has been here his entire life, the clients that were built prior to me getting here and that we've acquired since then, and then also just our property management team. It's 95% of the entire project is them working with the residents, refining the tenant base, implementing the value add plan. So it stands to reason, like, they have to be completely on board. And for us, it works better if we're working with our own people who have skin in the game and basically getting information straight from the source kind of thing, rather than a third party relationship where it's not a huge difference to them if they report correct information or incorrect information.
I'm very fascinated by the scaling syndication company. I believe you said you had around 20 employees when you got there, and now you're up to 75. Is that correct?
It was far less than 20.
Wow.
We were a fairly small organization. And while the corporate team is now probably closer to around 20, I would say like between our accounting teams, our teams, the ops side, HR, that kind of thing, it's definitely 100+ person company, I would say right now. And yeah, that's just, it seems like it's been like 5 years. I think part of that is COVID, but like the other part is just like so much has happened that it seems like it should have taken way longer.
How do you decide which team members or which employees you guys have selected to bring onto your team, and where does all the money to pay them come from?
I can't really get into the books because I'm not a CPA, but I do know that hiring is a big, huge focus for the property side of the business. And just like any other sort of hiring decision, it can be an incredibly positive or bad thing if you either hire the right person or hire the wrong person. So one thing that I think that has been incredibly beneficial is that Eli's team has really kind of been in some form or fashion connected to or been part of his network for a long time. So he had a really, really strong network of just leasing consultants and things like that in the area, because they had been working in San Antonio property management previously. And then from there, it's just kind of been, I kind of feel like a butterfly effect, because a lot of times we hand select, I think, people who just have like a willful determination to kind of level up their life. They want to change things. So we're not really kind of focused so much on finding people that have this sort of sterling multifamily pedigree. We're trying to find people that are hungry and that have skills and that want to work hard, and then give them the training and the program that Eli and his team has been working on and perfecting since even before DJE. Give that to them and just make them trust in the process that if they do these things, it could be a career changing moment for them.
Do you guys spend any time focusing on like the vision and the values of the company and integrating that amongst the entire organization?
Absolutely.
So how does that work? What does that look like?
It's everything from subconscious and little things that I do as far as like dropping in or literal verbatim values interspersed between in communications throughout the company or with our investors. There's a lot of very kind of like subconscious things that I drop in things in communications, newsletters, things to investors, where I'm consciously using values language that connects to our website to reinforce kind of stylistic and attitudinal approaches to how we handle communication and also just escalated situations with the project. So yeah, I mean, like there's definitely like kind of a, for example, like one big thing I use a lot is one of our values is everyone involved wins. And that is one that like we really kind of like buckle down on. And I drop a lot just, you know, conversationally and also in email. Then all the way to the opposite side of the fence where it's like Eli, Devin and I are, you know, I'm sitting down with them and I'm walking through them almost through like a mini focus group to really kind of identify like, if these sort of things are still consistent, how do they show up in our business now versus 2 years ago versus 12 years ago kind of thing? There's definitely, with such a huge, huge push being behind trying to capture, document, and grow this culture that has started here at this company, there is definitely a conversation and a narrative and an attempt to try and be deliberate about making sure that we're being mindful of like how that showed up in our business in the past and what that value meant then, and like, how does it show up now? And how does it, what does it mean now? How does it show up now? But I don't think that there's any sort of fundamental change as far as our direction that trumps any or changes any of those things. It's just basically of like, how have we changed and how have those values changed in a way that they show up practically on an everyday basis?
As far as DJE is concerned, what do you guys want to do over the next 5 years? What are you guys looking to scale into? Are you guys wanting to acquire a specific number of units or just continue to do things at your current rate? Tell me more about what you guys have in mind for the vision of the future for DJE.
The vision for DJE beyond 2022 and 2023 really kind of resides with Devin. And he releases, lets those things out to the world as they need to be. For right now, we're focusing on continuing to do more multifamily. We want to do another 400 units before the end of the year. That's the goal, and that's what we're marching towards. And then 2023 is probably going to be even more of that. Continuing to focus on the ranch business, which are some short-term high-yield products, that income products that we rolled out last year that had a really, really big appetite with our investor base. Mm. So more of that likely. And then just kind of keeping our eyes open. I kind of mentioned that at the beginning of COVID, kind of rolled off workforce so much and kind of wanted to take risk off of the table in the form of like bloated CapEx and renovation budgets, and really going to focus more on cleaner assets where there's an operational and management play there. But with that being said, I think that we looked at and almost acquired a Class A property. That being said, it was still a value-added play, but it was Class A. And then there was the ranch stuff that we did this past year, and that's kind of become a viable product and vertical for us. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's just an kind of an open-minded mentality towards where's value in the real estate game and how can we squeeze the value out of it.
Yeah, all syndicators need to be able to adapt, pivot, and evolve. And any real estate investor in general, keep that in mind. If you keep doing the same thing over and over as your competition is changing, you may end up a little bit behind. All right, let's jump into the lightning round. First question, what's the best vacation you've ever taken?
Ireland. One of the 5 times I went to Ireland. It could be either my first time for St. Paddy's Day in Belfast or the last time whenever I watched my son take his first steps on Christmas morning in Dublin.
I've heard Ireland a lot on the, as an answer to that question.
It's a magical place. The people are the best part of it, though.
What's your favorite childhood memory?
If favorite childhood memory would probably be, I'm just going to go with my first concert, which was Guns N' Roses, Metallica, and Faith.
That sounds like
what Houston Astrodome.
That's a good first concert. Very cool.
I'm favorite... still ringing it.
Favorite book of any kind?
Right now, it is Confederacy of Dunces.
Fascinating. This is a short answer on this question. What's the best way to raise capital from your perspective?
Consideration. Consider and know your audience. Communication. Know how to communicate with that audience. Yeah, I would say those are really kind of the big ones. Consideration, communication, responsiveness. Don't ever hide and don't put lipsticks on pigs. Like, don't color things with rose-colored glasses. Give people the truth, be authentic, and don't hide.
All right, how long do you want to live?
As long as I'm supposed to.
You got to put a number on it.
I'm going to go with 88.
Very cool. Do your spiritual philosophies have anything to do with your success in business?
Yes and no, because I don't consider what I consider spiritual philosophies, I'm not sure if are considered generally spiritual philosophies.
Fair enough. What do you love best about being an artist as a painter?
I hate puzzles. Like, literally, like looking at a puzzle box, I'm just like, no, I'm out of here. But that's like, painting is just a puzzle to me. At some point I've seen in my head or I've dreamed all the pieces, and I just have to bring it to fruition. And the not knowing if I can do it or remember it is really exhilarating.
What do you love best about ranch syndications?
Fast, man. Come ups fast, we strike fast. It's like a war party almost kind of thing. I like that it's fast and that it's like all hands on deck and we're just trying to get closed on this thing.
Have you ever experienced a miracle or had a near-death experience?
Absolutely.
Tell me.
Near-death? It was just kind of being in the wrong place, wrong time. And it kind of gave me a big eye-opening experience about the universe and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, definitely an eye-opening experience. And it kind of, I think, made me have a more healthy relationship and more mature relationship, not only with my son, but also just the universe and the world.
What kind of impact would you like to leave in the world?
I want my impact to be most obviously noticed or seen or felt just in the difference I make in my son's life.
I love that. Very cool answers on the lightning round. Shout out to the Capital Raiser Nation. Thanks for tuning in. Please leave us a 5-star written review. Shout out to Legacy Acquisitions, my fund management company, and our sponsors, Good Ag Investment Syndication Pro, Caitlin Patel, Jerome Myers, and PitchDecks.com with Richard Wilson and the Family Office Club. If you're looking for a Capital Raiser coach, I invite you to check out my coaches at therealestateaccelerator.com to get $1,000 off their program. Just mention our show. All right, man. Justin, how does the audience get a hold of you?
Justin at djetexas.com or go to djetexas.com and look at the bottom right-hand corner. There's a box for a 15-minute consultation.
There you go. Do you have any last words of wisdom for the aspiring capital raiser, marketer, or syndicator as they scale their business?
No matter how big or small, there's going to come a point, and it's usually about a month to maybe 3 weeks before close where you're going to be in the red and it's going to look bleak. Just keep grinding, keep your head down, keep pushing, and be communicative and be honest. But at the same time, just have faith in yourself that it will happen.
Love it. Cool, man. Covered a bunch of really fascinating topics, the licensing, the private equity firm, the direction of your company, and the scaling that's going on there is all very fascinating. We have around 8 people on my team, and we're looking to grow that. I'm not sure exactly how big, but I'm very curious about people that have scaled in their business, what it's looked like, and always looking for some pointers there. So thanks for that. Absolutely. With that, we're going to let you go, man. This has been a blast. Thank you for coming on the show, Justin.
Thank y'all. Thanks for having me.